Welcome to the Aquila Report and Weekly Review. This is Dominic Aquila along with Paul Harrell for our first podcast of the Aquila Report and Weekly Review for 2024. So we're already 4 years, 4 years into the 20s, or the 2020s anyway, after that. So it's good to be back with you after a couple of weeks away for the holidays. And glad that we can be a part of you. As you know, the Aquila Report Weekly Review is the opportunity for us as two individuals who have gotten the top 10 articles that were chosen by the Aquila Report readers that were part of what the Aquila Report had in its reporting last week. And now we present them to you. And then tomorrow on Tuesday, today's the 8th of January, tomorrow the 9th, you'll receive a newsletter with all of these articles hyperlinked and ready for you to listen to. So we're so glad to start the new year, and it seems like we have a good set of articles that are coming up here. Just as a little encouragement to go visit the Aquila Report, that the top 50 articles for 2023 are going to be running all this week on the Aquila Report. So just go to theaquilareport.com and they'll be at the top of each page for the day of articles. And so you get 10 a day, starting from 50 to 41. And then tomorrow, that's today, tomorrow you'll have 40 to 31 and so forth all the way through Friday. And then you'll finally see who on Friday, who the top 10 and who what was the number one article that was read by the readers in 2023. And it's always fun to see that. So you'll get to see that doing each day this week. I'm sure some of those might even be part of the top 10 next week. So Paul,
yes, sir.
Good Christmas.
Happy New Year. Year.
Yes,
yes sir. We had a blessed Christmas. I mean, it was just great.
Good. Yeah.
Precious time with family. So
that's great. Same here. Well, my wife and I were home alone for Christmas, but right afterwards, then a number of families came in, children with grandchildren and great grands and so forth. And it was just a wonderful time. So,
I'm one of these guys. I'm one of these guys that, I mean, as soon as Christmas is over, I want to know what day it's on, you know, the next year.
Remember, it's a leap year this year, so it's going to jump 2 days. So
Wednesday.
It'll be Wednesday next time.
Right. Mm-hmm. Flat in the middle of the week. Can you believe that? And Thanksgiving is really late. I mean, it's really late in November this year. Anyway, it's just
everything changes, right?
Put up the Christmas lights a little bit early next year.
That's right. That's good. All right. Well, let's do our normal practice from the past as we begin the new year. And you read the list from 10 to 6. I'll read from 5 to 1, and we'll start away with our discussion.
Sounds good. So number 10, we have Daryl B. Harrison, The Real Problem at Harvard, and it's not DEI. DEI stands for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Number 9, Jonathan Sarfati, God created with functional maturity, not appearance of age. Number 8, Tim S. Suffield, Noah and the Curse of Ham. Interesting piece. Number 7, Samuel Sabak on the list. Some conservatives hate CRT for the wrong reasons. And number 6, Carl R. Truman, The Pope, Same-Sex Blessings and Protestants.
Okay, and then number 5 is Nathan Eshelman, Antichrist Blesses Same-Sex Couples. So those two articles are together dealing with what the Pope did recently with the blessing or saying the priest can do same-sex couples blessings. Number 4 is, let's see the thing, my computer's look. It's Naomi Wolf Wants Us to Face the Beast by Bill Muhlenberg. Then number 3 is Questions a Pastor Doesn't Want to Ask. This is by Ruben. And let's see, number 2 is 5 days per week Bible reading program for 2024. And actually, it's going to give more than the 5 days, but that's what the leading one is. And that's by Palmer Robertson and his wife, Joanna Robertson, as they put that together. And then number 1 by Larry Ball, Why Are Wilson's Children Warriors? And he's asking that as a question, Larry Ball is. And it's an op-ed piece because there were a number of articles that have been up in the last couple of months of 2023, talking about Doug Wilson from Moscow, Idaho, and the what he does and those who are followers, and using the phrase Wilson's warrior children. And so Larry Ball is asking the question, why William Wilson's children warriors? There's something missing in modern reform world, Larry Ball says, and a multiplicity of young men are flocking to Wilson and others to fill that vacuum. It's more than just a mood. And he says, in this article, that I've never met Doug Wilson personally. I have been present twice when he spoke, once at a meeting in Louisiana and another time in Knoxville. And he goes on to speak about warrior children, Machen's warrior children. He said that that John Frame had written an article on that. I do not think, however, that Gordon, that Mr. Gordon, and it was Chris Gordon's article about the warrior children, gets to the important points about Wilson and his followers. Gordon deals more with the substance and form, and I think he's right on target here. There's something missing, as we said, in the modern reform world, with a multiplicity of young men flocking to Wilson and others to fill a vacuum. So at what Larry Ball is saying is these young men are working, you know, following someone who is giving them something of substance as far as they're concerned. The many young men are not hearing from the non-cultural theologians they need to in order to be good fathers and to be faithful in their calling and life outside the church. The application of God's law, which challenges the modern culture, is missing. Thus, they often go home after church and get their needed supplements, as in vitamins, from cultural theologians via various social media outlets. Now, this might be a surprise to many non-cultural theologians, but it's happening. Cultural ministries like Canon Press and the cross-politic programs are quickly growing in popularity. And so he's saying there's something missing in Christianity as a substance in terms of what is it that the message that's being presented, and what is it that is being spoken of by Wilson and those who are followers of him. And so he, Larry Ball, deals with those, and he says the biggest opposition to cultural theologians is the Westminster West Seminary. He says that they promote an idea of the Bible is for the church only and has nothing to say to the civil magistrates. He disputes this and believes that cultural theologians are the non-cultured theologians are not really understanding the full picture, and that's the nature of his op-ed piece. So he says, modern America is now Gomorrah in the hands of cultural Marxists. We tend to forget and ignore the fact that Marxism itself has a history, and its history always results in the shedding of blood of millions of people. And so we as believers not only need to know about the gospel, but also how we are to be engaged in the life of the culture and how we're to be doing it. So obviously, in the reader's opinion, reading what Larry Ball had to say, we're moved by it, or at least we're interested in his take on where things are probably in the broad evangelical and also the Reformed Church with reference to engaging culture, which is, I think, the dominant theme that's in this particular op-ed piece. So, Paul, we start number one with questions about how the church and how believers are to engage the world in which we're living with the gospel, and also the lifestyle that Christians are to have in so doing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's a anti-Christian bias that's just growing, you know, by the day, leaps and bounds. So it's not a surprise that there is an attempt, you know, to organize a resistance in some way. Or that those people who are doing that and more actively engaging the culture with platforms, that is not, you know, stirring the discussion and drawing, you know, people to that. I think it's interesting that he kind of calls it supplement. You know, people are supplementing. I'm not necessarily one of these guys that wants, you know, cultural topics forced into sermons. I don't want that at all, quite frankly. Right. I don't think that is, you know, appropriate in a worship service. I mean, if the text speaks to it, great, you know, and if it speaks to the sin of the age, great, and that happens. The differentiation of these two categories, non-cultural theologians and cultural theologians, you know, I appreciate him trying to make the distinction. When he writes this, as a balance, before I say anything, I should mention several church leaders and conferences that add much to the discussion of Reformed theology and piety today. They are godly men. These godly men are included in the Gospel Reformation Network, PresbyCast, Together for the Gospel, the Founders Ministry of the Sword, and the Trowel, TS and TT, and the G3 Ministries, Gospel, Grace, and Glory, to name a few. These represent prominent pastors, many of large churches, and their numerous conferences, web pages, and podcasts. I call these non-cultural theologians. They indeed have much to offer, but the problem is that they're not dealing with the issues that are drawing young men like a magnet to Wilson and Moscow. Now, I would just say my first thought was, okay, I see that point, but that's not necessarily the case. Because we have no idea the private conversations that are being had among people in those ministries with their flock. Even those who subscribe to, let's say, the Gospel Reformation Network, but don't preach at the conferences, but they agree with that, the aims of the Gospel Reformation Network. You don't know the private conversations that they're having with their flock about these very issues. You know, maybe not reading it into Scripture where it doesn't belong, but those conversations are taking place. I still see Larry Ball's point, though, however. I do see it. I just wanted to put that qualifier in there because I think that is important. You're inevitably going to have to paint with a broad brush when you're dissecting this issue. I think it's interesting, again, that I think Larry Ball does kind of hit on the fact that one of the reasons I think so many people are questioning Doug Wilson is because there are a lot of people in the pews that really, really appreciate what he is saying and how he is saying it. Maybe not all the time how he's saying it, but I think for the most part, they're kind of relieved that somebody's articulating what they are feeling as the world is burning around us. And we're witnessing, as we've talked about before, Dominic, the re-paganization of the West.
Okay? Exactly. And that's something that I thought about in that regard. And the re-paganization, which is something that, you're right, the number of articles we had near the end of 23 that were speaking about this, that we're going back to what old Rome was when the Christianity was beginning in the New Testament age. And so when Pentecost came, and there were the 120 followers in the upper room. The Holy Spirit fell on them. And then not too long after that, 3,000 were converted after the preaching by Peter. That when you would look at the whole population of the world at that point, and you would draw a big circle to represent the globe, and then you would say, put a pinprick in that world, how many believers existed at that point? It wasn't very big. The church and the new converts, as well as those that trusted Christ already, would just be this little tiny prick if you did it on a whiteboard or something, and hardly visible. And then it began to grow. And so over the next 300-400 years, the impact, moral impact of, and the salty impact of the gospel began to have a, work mightily without one single law being passed by a Roman Senate to say, this is what we're going to do culturally. So it's something to say that have we lost that cultural age where the practical and fiery and salty impact and imperatives of the gospel have been lost in the Christian living and life.
Right.
And so I think that's the direction that we're probably going to have to look, because if the repaganization is in fact happening, instead of mourning the fact that what we used to have is doesn't exist anymore, well, it didn't exist in the early church either for the first 3-4 centuries, until the church grew to the point where its testimony was quite prominent, became more prominent.
Yeah.
And so forth. So that's what we're going to be dealing with next, I think, Paul.
Yeah. I do want to add, I didn't mean to say that I think that people like Wilson are, putting political topics into their sermons. I can't really speak to that because I don't know. I haven't really listened. I've listened to a lot of Doug Wilson on the internet and read his blog, but I haven't actually listened to a lot of his sermons. So I don't necessarily know if that's the case. So I didn't mean to make that accusation at those people. I don't want to do that. But I will say, I do think The issue I think with this bigger issue is you know, Christians, when they have political power, should they use it for the Christian end? And that's the debate. And there are plenty of Christians that still are in positions of elected authority that have been told to kind of leave their faith there. From what I can tell, leave, yep, you know, neutrality, and we've got to put out this neutrality. And I think that's just a myth. Well, the last thing I'll say, and I'll shut up, okay, I promise. Just a slight disagreement I have with Larry Ball here. And it's only because I went over Mark chapter 1 recently. But when he says that, and he breaks down the substantive issues, number 1, number 2, and number 3, number 4, these four. Number 3, he says the kingdom incarnation is another issue. Jesus came announcing the presence of the kingdom and not the gospel. I mean, I wouldn't say anything if it wasn't for the fact that Mark chapter 1, I just got through reading it, and it literally says that, you know, Jesus was proclaiming the gospel. Right. In Mark 1. So just not sorry to be a stickler about that, but just wanted to throw that out there.
Well, it's number one. So when you get your top 10 list tomorrow, you check it out. And, you know, Larry is always engaging and thought provoking. So that's good. Well, number two takes us to reading the Bible. So there's always a flurry of activities. You know, you make resolutions for the new year. Which hopefully will last longer than 2 weeks. But one of them that people make usually is I need to be more faithful in my Bible reading. And so to help with that, usually there are articles, and we run them on the Aquila Report quite often. This year, the one that's sort of taken hold and is number 2 on the top 10 is 5 days per week Bible reading program for 2024. Now, that was the beginning. There are actually 9 different possibilities offered because this article recognizes that each of us is different about how we use our time when we're reading the Bible, or what kind of pattern is suitable to us. So instead of saying, okay, here's the plan, it's presenting a number of them. So one of them is the 5-day plan. So since it's number one, it gets the headline. Instead of 5 days per week, unlike many Bible in the year reading programs, this one schedules only 5 days per week rather than 7. So although each day's readings are a little longer, it provides a way of catching up for those who fall behind their reading. And there is here with each one of these places where hyperlink, where you can get the schedules and you can get how that really looks on paper and spreadsheets and so forth, to help you in the planning. A second way is a redemptive historic approach. Instead of reading the Old Testament from beginning to end in the order in which the books appear in our Bibles, these readings are arranged in such a way that the reader can follow the unfolding story of God's redemption of his people. There's also the chronological order. There is a Bible that's called the chronological Bible. So it's printed and the books are put in the order in which they were perceived, as much as history can help us, how they were written, both Old Testament and New Testament in terms of time. One gospel each quarter, the New Testament phases of Revelation, and it gives some examples on that. The Psalms in coordination with other readings. So you include reading through the Psalms a number of times during the year because of that, so forth. So in this article, it just gives you a number of options. So choose one. The important principle here is that we're called to understand God's word and to read it, to know it. But there isn't just a one size fits all. We're all different. Some it even suggests here is recognizing that not everybody reads in the morning. Some people are day people. Some are night people. The point is, the principle is, read the Bible and do it in a way that will get that word, as the psalmist says in 119, that the word will be hidden in your heart so you will not sin against God. So this is the time to do it. A list is helpful. We all need guidance. Here's some very good helps in this article.
I like it. 5 days a week instead of 7, because they know you're not going You're going to miss a day or two. this is good, though. I mean, I think it's realistic. It certainly puts the T in total depravity.
Okay. Here's another article by Ruben Beninfort. Questions a pastor doesn't want to ask. Questions a pastor doesn't want. I'll get it right. Every pastor knows the value of a good question. When visiting with someone in your care, it can be your question that moves the conversation in a helpful direction. So how are things at home? Have you been reading in your devotions? There's calling you to attention to that. Any plans for the year? What's been giving you joy in the last while? Questions exacerbate of the layers or move them along. Questions uncover maybe something that's hidden and the like. In his mind, he's forming questions and he'd like to ask one slice of some of the conversation niceties and generalities. So he hesitates, but he's fearful. What will be the hard questions and what will they uncover? Why do you seem to be angry today? How is it going with your sexual temptation? Are things good between you and your wife? The point is that these are questions that we all should ask, evaluative questions, and hopefully we're getting help on. Paul, I really think in with the concept of that, the teaching ministry of the church is an extension, or basically be defined as discipleship. Discipleship means that we want to be conformed to Christ. We want to look like him. We want to think like him and act like him. And so to have believers exhorting us and encouraging us in these things and where we can reflect on things, it's really good. The point is there are questions that a pastor doesn't want to ask, but he should anyway. And maybe we need to ask them of ourselves, and also ask others as a point of encouragement, not to rebuke, not to play one-upmanship, but encouragement to be discipled and to grow in the grace and knowledge of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in a proper community, not always, but I mean, if you get asked that question, you know, why are you angry today, man? I mean, if I'm being angry and I know I'm angry and then I get asked about it by a brother, it's kind of a relief in a way. Like, I think a lot of people would like to get that off their chest, you know, and it helps them address it in a much more efficient way than just not having anybody to help you, you know, through this walk of sanctification, you know?
Yep. And then another direction, number four, Bill Muhlenberg. Naomi Wolf wants us to, quote, face the beast. And there is the book that she has written called Facing the Beast, and Courage, Faith, and Resistance in a New Dark Age. By the way, by just that title, Paul, it goes back to that whole repaganization that we've been talking about. And Naomi Wolf brings that out in this book. This is a review by Bill Muhlenberg of her book, Facing the Beast. It's time to wake from our slumber, he writes. It's interesting how some individuals make a radical about face as they become aware of the inconvenient truths and unpleasant realities. That was true of so many people who endured the COVID years. They came to see that something was not right, and that so much of what we thought to be true wasn't. They came to realize that they were being lied to and they were being conned. Many such people are mentioned, but American writer Naomi Wolf is certainly one of them. She has been on a journey in this regard. In her brand new book, Facing the Beast, Courage, Faith, Resistance, and the New Dark Age, she continues to speak out on vitally important issues that she has addressed in previous volumes. And so he gives some examples of that. He says, everything that happened, though, in 2020 through 2022 really turned her world even more upside down than it had been. Like so many others, she came to see something very sinister, even satanic, was happening. She had been such a key part of the woke progressive left for so many years, but the COVID wars made it clear that most of the left was not, and not is all N, capital N, capital O, capital T, was not on her side anymore, or rather, she was no longer on their side. And her new book deserves a proper review, which I hope to do, but just alerting people to it in the form of quoting from her introduction and other parts of her book, just so that you'll know what she's talking about. And so Bill Muhlenberg gives good quotes and is part of this more overview than a review at this point. Finally ends up by saying, as mentioned, a proper review of this important book will hopefully be forthcoming, but it is hoped that just by quoting parts of the introduction, I've encouraged many of you to go and get the book. And it is nearly Christmas. This is written before the end of 2023. So why not buy a second copy and give a copy to you, your friend? So just interesting, the things that what she hopes to achieve in this book, what readers will find in the book is story of a world that has changed bit by bit into its dark opposite. I'm sure it mirrors many of their own stories. On looking back, I sought to describe three things. First, I wanted simply, and this is Naomi Wolf quote, being quoted in the introduction, I wanted simply to be an accurate and reliable witness to a world in a state of degradation. And I hope also to testify to seeds of its rebirth. In this task, I bore in mind a work by an ordinary citizen, a German scholar of French literature, Victor Klemperer, who kept a journal during the descent of the barbarism of the Nazi years. It was published as I Will Bear Witness, a Diary of the Nazi Years, 1933-1941. When I read that book, I realized how important it was to have journals, since they record indeed how fascism does not descend overnight, but moment by moment, loss by small loss. I was also very moved and related by Klemperer's stance squarely in the ideals of the Enlightenment, in his belief that culture and literature, the ideals of civilization, cannot be abandoned and must ultimately surely save us again. His faith in the ideals of Enlightenment and a civilized culture heightened his shock and outrage when those ideals were trampled before his eyes. I too feel, as I witness the destruction of our world in the West, that we must cherish the memories of a civilized and literate society if we are to save one another and rebuild. So one task I set for myself was simply to, as Klemperer, to bear witness. So that's just one example of what has caught Bill Muhlenberger's eye, and this book and this review, or overview probably is a better way to put it, of Naomi Wolf's book, that she feels betrayed by the progressiveness, the downgrade, the downslope, and should we dare say it, Paul, the slippery slope. And
yeah, there we
because
go.
Because we've already slipped down that slope.
I'm very familiar with Naomi Wolf and her work. I've seen many interviews that she's done, specifically over the COVID tyranny and the mRNA injections. And to hear this when she writes, the moment I began asking basic questions on my Twitter feed, specifically about the novel mRNA injections, the kinds of questions I had asked for three decades about silicone breast implants, about high estrogen levels in birth control pills, about dangerous IUDs, about feminine mesh or industrial hospital birthing practices, and high for-profit C-section rates, meaning these women get pushed into C-sections because it's more money when they don't need to have it. My bio changed everywhere online and all at once. Instead of me being described as a leading voice of third wave feminism with a string of honors, degrees, and awards after my name, I was now identified from the first sentence on Wikipedia and everywhere else as a conspiracy theorist, not being aware yet that AI had already been deployed journalistically. I did not even understand how that overnight change in my reputation had been accomplished. Really good stuff here. And I encourage everybody out there to follow the research that she's done about the dangerous vaccines. I mean, it just is what it is. That if you go look into her work, that's what you're going to find.
Right. So. Along with other things. But right. Yes. That's the thing that shook her foundations. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, number five by Nathan Eshelman, pastor in Orlando, Florida. Antichrist blesses same-sex couples. Now, of course, the Antichrist here, as he's using it as in the context of at least the Pope and the Roman Catholic system, He says, God is not the author of confusion, but of peace and godliness and of order. Today, the Roman pontiff speaking on behalf of Jesus Christ and his church declared the pompous words of Daniel 7:8, and that yet that same-sex couples in union could be blessed. This is an about-face, as he said in 2021, that he would not allow for gay unions to be blessed because God cannot bless sin. Surely now he can, according to the one who shows himself to be in the place of God. This deceptive heresy is confusing at best and outright wicked at worst. He also says that it's confusing and evil. It should not surprise us to hear that the Antichrist has sought to deceive the LGBTQ plus community into believing that he loves them, for he is a deceptive office bearer. The changing of the law of God is central to his work, and this declaration against the Church of Christ stands on the word of a word of truth. So it is a short article by Pastor Eshelman, but he ends up by saying confusion, chaos, disorder, wickedness. No wonder the scriptures refer to his office as that Antichrist. So we're going to see in the next article a little bit more expansion on this evaluation of what effect the Roman pontiff and his saying that it's okay to for priests to bless same-sex unions, and what effect it's going to have. So
I think what we're going to see in the Catholic Church, Dominic, is I think they're prepping for, you know, a female priesthood of some kind. I think, you know, if you go ahead and bless same-sex couples, you can't really go back and say, well, you know, you can't be a female priest. You know what I mean? Because of that scale, that slippery slope, whatever. And so they've got this synod on synodality that they're having to work with, or that they're going through. It's this synod on synodality, which in that they're asking for the opinions of women and, you know, everybody in the progressive mindset to try to essentially reevaluate the hierarchy of the Catholic Church and change it. So
exactly. And so just with that in mind, let's just go to the Article 6. This is by Carl Truman, writing in First Things, where the Pope, Same-Sex Blessings and Protestants is the title. He says the confusion, and notice both articles use the word confusion, surrounding the Pope's recent fiducia supplicans, a document that is ambiguous about whether Catholic clergy can bless those same-sex relationships, says about what the times we're living in. Catholic theologians will argue that Rome has not changed, that it's a fog of distinctions contained in this latest statement means that it does not affect the core Roman dogma. But this is not the point. The watching world cares nothing for such sophistry and sees here a fundamental shift. And it seems naive to think that a fundamental change in pastoral practice will not lead to a significant transformation of attitude. Such compromises, and this is most surely a compromise, always ends up being far more sympathetic to the position they are moving toward than from that which they're moving away. When the Pope sows chaos within his church in a matter of gay blessings, it is likely to affect us all, Catholic, clergy, laity, and certainly, but also Protestants. And the reason he says that, for most Protestants, this is a reminder that the papacy is not a cure-all for all alleged problems surrounding Protestant notions of scriptural sufficiency and clarity. He says Paul promoted both the importance of scripture and a church marked by ordained office for the preservation and transmission of the faith. Neither on its own can do the task by itself. And if Protestantism is vulnerable to not taking the church seriously enough, then a strong and hierarchical ecclesiology is vulnerable to generating its own forms of chaos. But just further down in the article, after he evaluates some of the statements that the Pope gave, he has says, this will also affect Protestants. That's the point, part of the point of this article. One is what Pope did and how will it affect Catholicism itself, moving towards something that is more cultural and the sort of a mainstay of today, and moving away from something, what it's the standard bearer. And he says, even though it happened to the Rome in the Roman Church, he says this will also affect Protestants. Whether we like it or not, the officer class of our culture cares little for debates about transubstantiation and papal authority. Makes no real distinction between Catholics and Protestants. In its eyes, talking about the broad culture, in its eyes, we are all Christians, and thus the shenanigans of the Pope will be put pressure on us all. The argument will be that if Rome can change, why can we not all change? The possibility of sheltering under the broad cultural umbrella that Rome has provided will be withdrawn on this issue, and we will feel the pain of that. So that is a thrust, and he has a few other things to say. Truman does. So watch for it. Now, just one other context here, Paul, that I thought as I read and reread this article, appreciate Carl Truman writing it, because it will have an effect. It probably already has, and or is already beginning to. But remember, one of the things that we said over the last 4 or 5 years is that we've struggled with the whole revoice issue, that the question about what does the scripture have to say about human sexuality, biblical sexual ethics, and especially within the context of the Presbyterian Church in America, of which we're a part, and its impact, you know, in the broader Reformed community, that revoice forced the church to have to really work hard to reshape, rethink what it's going to do in terms of the biblical sexual ethics. And I think the PCA at this point has come out on the right side, that it made the right decisions. It amended its Book of Church Order and had a good study committee report that helped to keep it on the straight and narrow, so that there's no side B, there's no affirmation of that, and that we're going to stick with what we believe the scripture's teaching. And so now, having just accomplished all that, now that's hopefully going to make us stronger and wiser and more careful on this. Here comes this, and what Carl Truman is suggesting, it still will affect Protestants, because he's saying from the position of the world, they just say church, and they don't know the internal distinctions between even the Protestant churches, much less between Protestants and Catholic. They'll just say Christianity is now affirming sex unions. And this will come up in some way in our various ministries within Protestantism, and definitely within the Presbyterian Church in America. So this is the time to us to be ready. We already are, maybe revoice was a good thing, and that it forced us to get ready for this, so that we are not tossed to and fro with this particular thinking.
I love that Carl Truman says, and you already mentioned it, he said, for Protestants and likely many Catholics, this is a reminder that the papacy is not a cure-all for the alleged problems surrounding Protestant notions of scriptural sufficiency and clarity. St. Paul promoted both the importance of scripture and a church marked by ordained office for the preservation and transmission of the faith. Neither on its own can can do the task by itself. And if Protestantism is vulnerable to not taking the church seriously enough, then a strong and hierarchical ecclesiology is vulnerable to generating its own form of chaos. The reason this kind of stuck out to me is I recently saw a guy that I respect by the name of Jeff Younger said that he blames a lot of the societal decay that we're seeing in America on the Reformation. And again, I respect this guy, but totally disagree, obviously, right? Because of here we have the Pope, you know what I mean? The idea was the Reformation produced, too many schisms and too much individuality. And so this rampant individuality that we're seeing is somehow a result of the Reformation, which I, totally reject that. But in the debate that's now going on right now, as people are starting to say, look, we don't even have the West is falling, the repaganization is happening. These institutions that we had that were supposed to protect our rights are not protecting our rights. So people are starting to even look at different forms of government, if you will, or they're starting to kind of long for, the governments of the past and that sort of thing. I think it's very important to point out that, yes, what you said, like, the, we do have a problem in our churches and the mainline churches. Look how the PCA did it. Look how the PCA, you know, moved it through the process. Didn't happen as fast as I wanted it to. That's certainly a, you know, legitimate criticism of the speed and how long it took. But, it, you know, the, but in the end, scripture was affirmed and, you know, now we move on, versus when you have a rogue pope, you know, who is not just, it's not just the gay thing. I mean, he's done all kinds of things. Every, just kowtowing to every cultural thing that the, that is thrown out there, the pope agrees with it. And of course, the culture right now is pagan and is getting more and more pagan. So, you know, it's certain, this certain, the pope doing what he does certainly supports, in my opinion, you know, the Protestant way of doing things, honestly.
Right. So anyway, read this article, you know, get ready for the questions that will come in local churches. Where will the Protestants fall on this, and the impact? Because it, there will be fallout, and we will be naive if we didn't. So Carl Truman has blown the horn, given a certain, very certain sound, so that we can at least begin and being aware of it.
I will just also add that the fact that we should just be thanking, you know, the Lord every day that the PCA landed where it did on the revoice issue. You know what I mean? I said it, we did through the process and everything else. I'm not, I don't want to credit the process as much as I want to just credit the Lord protecting us and blessing our blessing the PCA.
And I agree with that. That what I was saying, it was a, in one sense, a providence that we had to go through because we needed the, to gather the certainty that comes out of experience, and that was a providential experience on God's part for us.
Yeah.
Okay. The next article, number 7, by Samuel Say, some conservatives hate CRT, that's critical race theory, for wrong reasons. So in other words, they hate it, but not for the reasons that usually you should have. Not every conservative hates critical race theory for their righteousness. That's why some so-called conservatives have become woke on Israel. It shouldn't be surprising that people can hate the same thing for different reasons. So he says, for instance, Ibrahim X. Kendi and I hate white supremacy for different reasons. I hate white supremacy because I hate all kinds of racial discrimination. However, Ibrahim X. Kendi, who is prominent in the whole movement of CRT, hates white supremacy because he hates the kinds of some kinds of racial discrimination. So he gives a quote here from Kendi's book. If racial discrimination is defined as treating, considering, or making a distinction in favor or against an individual based on that person's race, then racial discrimination is not inherently racist. The defining question is whether the discrimination is creating equity or inequity, and we'll be dealing with the DEI thing in just a moment. If discrimination is creating equity, then it is anti-racist. If discrimination is creating inequity, then it is racist, and that's the definition he's working on. In other words, he believes that racial discrimination against Black people is unjust, but racial discrimination against white people is justifiable, which has a lot to do with the ordering of critical race theory. So Kendi hates the white supremacy for the wrong reasons. He doesn't hate white supremacy in principle. And in the same way, a vocal minority conservatives like Candace Owens hate critical race theory for the wrong reasons. They don't hate it in principle. That's why they're repeating woke talking points against Jews and Israel. And so at this point, he's speaking then to the conservative side of the political equation, and someone like Candace Owens, who's been very many people have appreciated in both her public spoken comments as well as her writing. So a few years back, I wrote an article about the relationship between anti-Semitism and social justice ideology. I explained that Hitler justified the Holocaust by claiming Jews were parasites who had infiltrated Germany, and in their greed, they oppressed Aryan Germans and forced them into poverty while Jews lived in privilege. If that sounds familiar, it's because it is precisely what pro-Hamas and pro-Palestinian groups are saying about Jews. That is why pro-Palestinian rallies are filled with Nazi sympathizers. So by saying the principle that he's talking about discrimination must be honored no matter what we're dealing with and how we're dealing with it. Otherwise, we'll get into a problem. So that's the basis on the title of the article, Some Conservatives Hate CRT for the Wrong Reasons. That is, they really don't understand the broader principle of equity that is, very quite important. He says, and one more quote, after all, genocide doesn't happen by accident. Casualties of war are not genocides. A genocide is a deliberate attempt to murder some or all members of an ethnic group or nation. Only one of Israel and Palestine has vowed to commit genocide. It is not Israel. Only one of Israel and Palestine has intentionally killed civilians. It is not Israel. So it's a moving piece that Samuel Say has given, something that will stir us all. And just one more, it's simply this. They hate critical race theory for personal and political reasons, not principled reasons, meaning they are Christless conservatives who hate some kinds of partiality, but not all. They hate critical race theory for the wrong reasons. They are not motivated by an objective hatred for sin. This is the same reason why conservatives like Candace Owens defend Andrew Tate. They are motivated by selfish ambition, not selfless righteousness. So you want to be stirred, forced to think about principles. Samuel Say provides it, I think, in this article.
I respectfully, I think Candace Owens hates CRT for the right reasons, respectfully.
Good.
So I'll leave it at that. I appreciate Samuel Say, just don't agree with him on everything. So,
right. Okay. And that's why we do this pro and con. That's right. And it goes back, not only to Adam, but maybe also to Noah and the curse. So that's our eighth article, Noah and the Curse of Ham, by, let's see, who's it? The author's name just slipped me here.
T.M. Suffield.
Yes, yeah, Suffield, right. Okay, so he's talking about the question of why was Ham cursed? Noah got drunk. He went to his tent and his... he went lying there without any clothes on. And so Ham came and observed him. And so he goes through and interprets, what was happening here. He says two broad options. Perhaps he spied on his father as a deliberate act to invade his privacy and tear down his authority, telling Shem and Japheth, the two other brothers, here is less laughing about how fat and wobbly Noah looked all passed out and more, trying to get them to support his usurping bid by taking the garment. Instead, having none of it, they replaced their father's authority to dramatize their refusal. And as you know, they placed the garment back on him, or something sexual happened. And he goes on and gives an option with regard to what Ham may have done, with a reference to his mother or Noah's wife. So which is more plausible? He says that's not the easiest to determine. I think the first makes slightly more sense of Shem and Japheth's action. Either way, it's all an attempt to usurp authority. So he places the action of Ham and what was really disturbing and why he was and eventually cursed was because he was seeking to overthrow the right place that Noah had in the family line. So how should we handle this text today? He says you can preach against alcohol abuse, but I think it's missing the central point. If you do, because Noah was drunk, if you do, you should consider also including the goods of wine and drink to bring and typify rest when they're well used. The grand story of the snake and the woman is lurking in the background. Of course, that's referring to Genesis 3, which begs for telling and applying. You can also see the authority, which is a good thing to see if it's even when it's misused, and submission, which was given to a good authority, which when given to good authority is a virtue, as well as how usurpation is not the way to respond to even the worst abuses of authority. Think of David in the cave with Saul, and God does not bless usurpers. So the issue is disobedience, usurpation, that's told in that narrative. There are other subplots that run through the narrative, but that I think is something for us to consider. So we've been helped here by Suffield and his explanation of that part, that portion of the book of Genesis.
Yeah, this is, I've always wanted to know exactly what it was that Ham did. And these, you know, because it is kind of cryptic. I know that's not the point of the article. I'm just saying, you've always read that part and you're saying, what exactly did Ham do to have his son cursed? You know what I mean? It was something, bad enough to have a generational curse. It's a good article. You should definitely check it out. Noah and the Curse of Ham.
Right. So Paul, I've been having a little, oh, here it comes. There was my computer was acting up just a bit. Anyway, God created with functional maturity, not appearance of age, by Jonathan Sarfati. And this is an extract from the author's landmark book, 2015 book, Genesis Account, a Theological, Historical, and Scientific Commentary. So he says, one striking feature of the record of God's creative acts in Genesis 1 is that the created things are fully ready to perform their appointed task. On day 3, God created the plants mature, already bearing seeds. Later on, days 5 and 6, he created animals as adults, ready to multiply, and finally Adam and Eve, likewise as adults, able to speak and multiply. For inanimate objects, on day 4, God created the sun and stars already shining. All this is creation with functional maturity. And part of the issue is that the contrast, he says, in contrast, there's an errant concept of creation with apparent age. One obvious flaw is that age has no appearance. Rather, we infer an age from appearance after making certain assumptions. All processes change over time and about the starting conditions. So what it says here is that there's always debate. Why would God was almost saying that God was deceiving when if he made everything with age. So we don't know how old Adam was, but it sounds like when he was created, he was a man. So if that was the first time we would have encountered him in our sense of a definition of human beings, we would say there's a man, but he would only have probably been, you know, a couple hours old or a day old and so forth. So there was functional maturity, but not it wasn't the appearance of age. We don't know how long, what age he might have been. And so we can't accuse God then of, you know, trying to be deceptive that coming to that point. And so anyway, I just think that it's a great article with that in mind. So he asks, for instance, does mature creation make God a deceiver? And he says, by no means. Since age is an inference based on assumptions, there is no deception involved when people making the wrong assumptions about the starting conditions. Indeed, how could God be deceiving when he was told, he has told us plainly when he created. Rather, those who deny the word are deceiving themselves. A charge of deception would only apply if the appearance of a fall history were created, one which was totally unnecessary for functional maturity. Some examples, and he goes on give some examples of these things. So very helpful insights that I think we can look to and see that what was God's intent and how did he do it, and that everything was able to function from day one as far as God was concerned in his creative acts.
Yes. And no death, which is something that really perplexes some modern scientists fight against entirety. I'll say this, The title, I would amend the title a little bit. I would just put Adam in there. So God created Adam with functional maturity. To me, this read God created, meaning like God was a created being and he was created with functional maturity, not the appearance of age. When I first read that, I took a double take, Dominic, and I was like, wait a second. Is this saying that God what is a created being? So anyway, obviously, okay, we know that's not the
case.
I'm
glad you said that. I didn't read it that way, but that's as an editor, I've realized that something you have to be careful where you punctuation sometimes. Otherwise, it could come out sounding different than what you intended. So it's in your mind and you reading it with that mindset. And
the hyperlink, it's the same headline. You didn't change that. You know, it's the exact same headline on headline on the hyperlink, which links to creation.com. So, you know, it's understandable.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, now we have Daryl B. Harrison, and the article, and this is our last one, article 10, The Real Problem at Harvard, parenthesis, and this is good, you have a parenthesis, so there's a good title, and it's not DEI. Regarding the situation at Harvard University involving allegations of plagiarism by its 30th president, Dr. Claudine Gay, and the subsequent calls for her to resign from that position, which is fundamentally at the root of the that institutional kerfuffle, is society's acceptance of the faulty notion that there is such a thing as human races. The legacy of 19th century eugenicist and evolutionist Dr. Samuel George Morton, widely regarded as the father of scientific racism and a staunch proponent of polygenesis, the idea that each human race was a separate act of creation, continues to cast a long and precarious shadow over today's culture more than 170 years after his death. Now, just having read that part of it, Paul, and putting it with the apparent functional maturity, you could see that that when we talk about worldview, that it can be sometimes literal world as opposed to just the concept of ethics or, you know, how you frame a phrase or an idea, that it because the idea of polygenesis, the idea is that each race was a separate act of creation and continues to cast a long and precarious shadow over the rest of culture. So, you know, when we think about Darwin and his theory of evolution, it while it was a driven as a scientific issue initially, it still has a philosophical base, and that affects all and runs its way in course through the whole of culture as a worldview. So in this article, then Daryl talks about the importance of scripture obliterating the idea of human races. And it does it by not only in one verse, which is he quotes as Acts 17:26, and when we read, and he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. So Acts 17:26 is referring to God. The one man, literally one in the Greek, is referring to Adam. The word nation is the Greek word ethnos, where from which we get the word ethnic, of course, which is it's derived. My point is that such a discriminatory ideology as DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, which Harvard's board has apparently adopted in its unwavering support of Dr. Claudine Gay, despite mounting evidence that she is in fact guilty of multiple instances of plagiarism, are fundamentally in the fruit of culture that has for nearly 2,200 years embraced the pseudoscience of Dr. Samuel Morton. DEI would not exist today were it not for the cultural and societal acceptance of the biological falsity that has so much, that is such a thing as human races. And so he goes on to explain that. So I think it's just a good read here to, you know, just give us more information as well as challenges to make sure that we understand words as they really to be understood. Yes. And this goes along also with the article that we have here that was dealing with, you know, discrimination and how we go about that, or CRT, critical race theory, and so forth. All that's tied together in this, and Daryl helps us to understand that a little bit better in this article.
Yeah, he says the real problem at Harvard is not DEI. The real problem at Harvard is that it has embraced as virtuous the sin of partiality under the duplicitous pretense of diversity, equity, and inclusion. I think since this has been written, I mean, I know Claudine Gay has now been, she's resigned. She's basically forced to resign. She got a golden parachute. She gets to stay on at Harvard, but she's no longer president. Because they don't, I mean, you know, she was a diversity hire, and she, the stuff that she plagiarized, and she did, you know, at least 50 times, in some cases lifting the entire, you know, half a paragraph out of her published works, you know, that were just not credited at all. And, you know, DEI is dangerous because it's going to lead, it's going to cost human lives. It may not cost human lives in academia, but they're putting it into the medical community now. And so that means you're going to have doctors that are not based on merit, but based on, you know, color of their skin. They want pilots, you know, people that operate aircraft that have to make emergency landings to be, you know, gone through this Marxist filter. And so it really actually is dangerous. And I was talking to a guy about this the other day, Dominic, and this is ironic. I mean, you want to know like textbook irony about them trying to, you know, get these racial outcomes they want through diversity, equity, inclusion. If it actually infects the medical community the way it already has, eventually, you know, you're going to have you're going to have people not trusting, because there's going to eventually be a wake of dead bodies, right? There's going to be a wake of malpractice, and you're going to have people, when you get a minority doctor, that are automatically not going to trust them. If you take these, you know, conclusions to their, or if you take everything to their inevitable conclusions, I think that extremely ironic that once this starts to happen, naturally, because your health is the most important thing to you, right? Naturally, or the health of your children, I think it's going to have the, you know, opposite effect potentially. And, you know, people might actually say, you know what, I'm going to go to this white doctor because, you know, if they made it through this diversity, equity, inclusion, if somebody's minority, I have no guarantee that they actually met the criteria that they needed to meet to be a competent doctor. So anyway, I digress.
Right. Well, no, if the judgment is made on race, which Daryl is saying doesn't really exist, but that's what the construct is, because yes, philosophically that's, and historically that's what it appears to be, that will create a problem. So these articles, by the way, we're talking about with all these articles that have touched on the, you know, the statements that we said from Carl Truman about the Pope's decision about saying it's okay to bless same-sex unions, and then the whole idea of CRT or diversity, inclusion, and equity and inclusion. All of those things do have real-world consequences, as we're seeing so often in hiring and firing and promotions and so forth. But at some point, the reality of the real world comes to bear. So as simple a statement or an illustration as you have a right to believe whatever you want to, and you can believe that you don't like the law of gravity. And if you ever test that, you know, you can just jump off a mountaintop or something and you will not go down. You know, what goes up goes down. But the principle of gravity doesn't change no matter what you think. And so that's just a real simple way of, you know, explaining this. And just because people have this idea that if you just wave the wand and everything is DEI, then it has automatically benefits all the way across the board that will enhance everybody and everything. And we know that's not the case. Well, Paul, they've come to the end of our first podcast of 2024, and some good challenges. And we trust that when you get the articles tomorrow and your newsletter from the Aquila Report, that you will take time to ponder them. We encourage you to just forward the email to friends and family to sort of expand your horizon of maybe discussion, share with small group members, Sunday school classes, and so forth. If you don't receive the newsletter, but you listen to this podcast, you can just go to theaquilareport.com, and there is a button there that you can just click on, and all it does is ask for your email address, and you can be assured we don't share our list of emails with anyone. We don't use it for any other purpose other than sending the newsletter out weekly. So it's great to begin, good beginning for 2024. And so, Paul, we look forward to others coming up. And until then, may the Lord give you a prosperous, a joy-filled, Christ-centered, and grace-filled year.